As Bobby Joe said, we have been reading together as a congregation through the first five books of the Old Testament, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. So if you've been following around, this last week was Leviticus. And so it may have been a little bit of a challenge. And as Dr. Drew Johnson says, Leviticus has a PR problem. And so as we think about Leviticus today, I'd like to help us rethink about the book of Leviticus, what it has to do with this. And so as we begin our thoughts on the book of Leviticus, I want to introduce you to the hyrax or the rock badger. This is the hyrax or the rock badger. We say, oh, yeah, so cute, right? And so, and I learned about the rock badger this week. There's a man named Mark Scarlatta. He's got a book called The Journey Through Leviticus, Holiness, Sacrifice, and the Rock Badger. And what he talks about in the book is how the rock badger is a symbol of kind of how quirky the book of Leviticus is. I mean, it's just a strange book in many different ways. It has all sorts of different things that it, as you read the book of Leviticus, I mean, who's not confused with it? I mean, if you're not familiar with the book of Leviticus, if you've never read the book of Leviticus, maybe you're new to the thing, you read through the book of Leviticus and there's all these different rules about sacrifices and how to sacrifice animals. And then there's the kind of clothes you can wear, what clothes you can't wear, how to cook food, what food you can eat, what food you can't eat. And it gets really complicated. It's not an easy book to read through because there aren't a whole lot of stories in it. But it's just this long list of rules. And even when you're finding the rules, they don't even seem to have any sort of order or sense to where they are. You'll be reading about even the one today. We're reading along, and 1 minute it's talking about idols, and then it's talking about what food you can't eat, and then it's talking about your fields. And reality is, I don't think I've ever met, well, no, I know one person I know whose favorite book of the Bible is the book of Leviticus, a colleague of mine from seminary who's now a professor who's written three different commentaries on the book of Leviticus. And he thinks of the book of Leviticus as a lush garden filled with amazing things, while as most of the rest of us think of it as kind of dry as dust, right? And there was, in fact, one pastor a number of years ago, he was starting a church, and he didn't know much about starting a church, and his very first sermon series was the book of Leviticus. And he actually did very well. The church grew, and he became a very popular teacher, but this is kind of what it's like. But the question is, many of us read, if we're reading, is why study the book of Leviticus? I mean, we have 65 other books in our Bible. All kinds of things do. Why do a sermon on it? One is because we're doing the Immerse study and this week is Leviticus, and so that's one reason to do the sermon. The other is, it's in our Bible. God gave it to us as his word. There's something in there, some value in there that he wants us to draw from. And so what I want to do today is kind of demystify, kind of help us understand a little bit more about the book of Leviticus. And we could spend a whole series on it. We're not going to, but why it's there and what it might say to us. So first of all, we have to think about where it fits in the larger story of the Bible, because that's important as we're reading. So a quick summary story of the Bible: God creates a good world. People choose to disobey, choose to follow their own way. God develops a redemption plan that involves a family, which will grow into a nation, the family of Abraham. This family ends up enslaved in Egypt. God rescues them out of Egypt and brings them then to Mount Sinai. In Mount Sinai, he makes another covenant, just as he made with Abraham, another set of promises to them about what he will do for them, and he calls them to be a certain kind of people. And there at Sinai, he also gives them instructions. So in the book of Exodus, the second half of the book of Exodus, the first half tells this escape from Egypt. The second half is this time at Sinai. And most of the time at Sinai is given to instructions about, most of the time in the book of Exodus is about building a tabernacle. A tabernacle was simply a tent for God to live in the midst of his people. So you can imagine this group of Israelites, they're out in the desert, they've got this tent, and at the center of the tent is this place called the Holy of Holies, and that is understood to be God's dwelling place on earth. God who is the Holy One, God who is the Pure One, God who is the Mighty One. And so the question in the back of the mind of the people is, we are not a clean people. We are impure people. We fail. We sin, just as Bobby Joe was talking about. We all miss the mark. So how can a holy and pure God live in the midst of these impure people? That's where the book of Leviticus comes in. It's a question, how do these two interact? And so how can God's presence and holiness exist in the midst of an unclean people? All right, so as we start, I want to talk about a couple terms. And this is so we're a little more introduction, think about what are these words that used and what do they mean? And so because we use them a lot and they can confuse us in different ideas. And I'll say, this is my understanding. I've looked at a number of different people understand the words a little differently, but here's how I understand it. So two sets of words. First set of words is holy and profane. Second set of words is pure and impure. So holy and profane, keep those. These are two different categories. So these are separate. So the first is holy and profane. Second is pure and impure. I had a handout for you. I was going to put some of these notes on, but our copy machine broke. So couldn't print off those things for you. So if next week I can print some of those off. So you're trying to scribble some of these things up. So we think the first one, holy. Holy is not used the same as the word pure. They're not. We shouldn't equate those two. We don't equate holy and pure, nor do we equate profane and impure. So what does holy mean? Holy simply means set apart. It's given a special status. And when we think about holiness, holiness is something conferred or given to something. It's pronounced about something is made holy because someone makes it holy or declares it holy, with one exception, God. God's holiness is not dependent on anyone declaring him to be holy. God's holiness is completely independent. So we have that category of holy. And then there's the word profane. If you hear the word profane, what do you think of? What's that? Serious. Oftentimes it has this sense of like it's bad, it's profane. But profane simply means it's common use. I mean, so there's the holy, which we said is set apart. And so profane is everything else. So everything that exists, all people are either holy or profane. Holy means they've been set apart for a special purpose. Profane means they're just common. So for example, and profane doesn't necessarily mean there's something wrong with it. For example, in the book of Leviticus, it talks about the days of the week. We have 7 days in a week. There's the 6 days of the week. And then the seventh day, the Sabbath day is holy. The other days are profane. Is there anything wrong with the other days? No. They're just common days. They're ordinary days. But the seventh day is holy. It's set apart. So we kind of keep that in mind of what those are. And so as we go through the book of Leviticus, we have holy and profane. But one of the things we notice in Leviticus is you didn't want the profane. Oftentimes they were trying to be separation. So the book of Leviticus deals a lot with separation and proper division. Second set of categories was pure and impure. Again, something is either pure or impure. We saw about the dishes, right? It's clean or it's not clean. I mean, there's no in-between. There's not a sort of pure or sort of impure. There's pure or impure. So these can kind of overlap between these two. And so when we think about it, and again, kind of category. So something can be holy and pure, holy and impure, profane and pure, profane and impure. And so there's these kind of these categories we're starting to put in our mind. But just keep in mind, holy is set apart, profane is common, pure and impure. Now, digging through a few more weeds, purity and impurity. So impurity or uncleanness, so some Bibles will use clean, unclean. There's two different kinds of unclean in the Bible, or two different types of impure. And the best terms, they're not the greatest, are ritual and moral. So the book of Leviticus deals with all sorts of ritual impurity. And it's like, it's things that just are part of everyday life. So for example, when a woman gives birth, she becomes ritually impure. Is there any sin involved with that? No. That's part of what God designed people to do. Women give birth and so they become ritually impure. And then there are steps to become impure or become pure. So it's a normal part of life. So it wasn't unusual during the course of an Israelite's daily life to go back and forth between those categories. Someday they'd be pure, some days impure because of things they encountered and just perfectly natural things. On the other hand, moral impurity is a sin. So one of the examples in the book of Leviticus in chapter 21, a man marries his brother's wife. He becomes impure by doing that. It's not the same as a woman giving birth. Why? Because there was a choice there. Two different categories. So we can kind of think of it this way again. So ritual impurity, they're unavoidable things. You know, they're from a natural behavior. They're communicable. You get kind of washed away with just water, ritual water. They're not sinful. Moral impurity, however, is avoidable. It has to do with actions. You can't transmit that. Me stealing something, you can't rub up against me and experience my moral impurity. And Moral impurity isn't washed away by just taking a ritual bath. There's atonement required in the sacrifices, and it's sinful. So we kind of have these two categories. Pure, impure, and within impurity, there's ritual impurity and moral impurity, for lack of a better word. So if you're reading through the book of Leviticus, there's a whole lot of things that don't make any sense. Like, why are certain things clean and unclean? So, for example, the rock badger. If you eat that, you become ritually impure. It's not a clean animal. Doesn't have anything to do with the fact that it's incredibly cute. It's just, for whatever reason, certain things are. Pigs are ritually unclean, which means bacon, it creates a moral impurity, at least for the ancient Israelites. And remembering again, these were codes given to the ancient Israelites at Sinai for them at a particular time and place. So there's a whole lot of work done applying it to us today. But the truth is, we don't really know, and we don't think the Israelites even knew why certain things were ritually pure and other things were ritually impure. There's lots of speculation, lots of ideas, but there was no way for them to know, like, why can I eat this bird and not that bird? Why can I eat this thing from the water and not that thing from the water? But then it gets complicated. How do we bring that today? So how do we apply it today? And the other question is, okay, so we've got these categories. There's all these different things, all these parts of life, pure and impure. Why did it matter? Because remember, what was at the center of the Israelites' camp? The tabernacle, God's presence. And all these rules about purity and impurity had to do with not defiling the tabernacle. And so people, before they approached, they needed to be cleansed either with water or blood. In other words, it was about keeping God's dwelling place pure. So we have holy and profane stuff, set apart, common. We have pure and impure, which could be either ritual or moral. All right. Do we need a stretch break? Oh, okay. It's a lot of background. Now we're going to go into our text. But this is important because the book of Leviticus is thousands of years old in a totally different context and a different culture. And so we read it and it's confusing and it's boring and it's frustrating because these are categories completely outside of our life. We don't go through life necessarily thinking about what foods are clean and unclean. Now, I know there's kind of a movement of clean foods, and it's about what's genetically modified or not modified and processed. That's not what they're talking about. These are things to do with ritual and purity, because if you ate certain things, you couldn't come. I mean, none of you stopped this morning and thought, what did I have to eat? Because maybe you ate something that made you ritually impure, and so you can't come and be with the people until you take a ritual bath. Maybe some of you. Did anybody do that? I didn't. Or you think about what clothes, because in the book of Leviticus, it talks about not wearing clothing of mixed fabrics. And so if you have a poly cotton blend on this morning, or wool and rayon or something, it's like, unless you have pure fabrics on, which then you would be ritually impure. And so you'd have to go through a process and be cleansed, and you couldn't come into the sanctuary. We don't think that way. We don't have that mindset, but we have to understand those terms because that was the ancient mindset of the ancient Israelites. And so how did that work into their thing? And so this is where we're going to go into our text. And so it begins with this in Leviticus 19. It says, "The Lord also said to Moses, give the following instructions to the entire community of Israel. You must be holy because I, the Lord, your God, am holy." So holy again, what? Set apart. And really, holiness, as I said, it is conferred, it's given to. So better way is that you will be holy because I am holy. The people of God are holy because God declares them to be holy. And the reason I say this, Exodus 19, "And you will be my kingdom priests and my holy nation." They become holy because God says they are holy. Not because of anything they do. They're made holy. Holiness isn't something you earn or gain. It's something that's declared, or you're set apart, you're made to be, because holiness is simply being set apart. We see the same thing if you're familiar with your New Testament, because oftentimes the people that Paul writes to in the letters, he refers to them as the saints, which means simply the holy ones. And if you've read any of Paul's letters, you know the people in his letters aren't exactly the best people. I mean, they do all kinds of things, but they've been declared holy. Or Peter says it about the church, "But you are not like that, for you are a chosen people. You are a royal priest, a holy nation, God's very own possession." So holiness, God says he's holy, completely dependent. But then he confers holiness and he says, you are to be my people. You are to be holy. You are to be set apart. The question is, what are we set apart for? If the people of God, if Israel, the Israelites, and then eventually us are set apart, what are they set apart for? To reflect God to the world. To be his priest, to declare the word. So John Walton says it this way. He says, instead of thinking what we must try to be, or instead of thinking that we must try to be holy, you know, does that mean pious, moral, spiritual, to please God or gain his favor? Instead of thinking that way, he says, we need to concentrate our best efforts on finding the most effective ways to be his people, reflecting his glory in an often dark world. Do you see the difference? What he's saying is, like, he's saying, we are set apart for a purpose, so our goal is to find, how do we reflect God to the world around us? And so that's where I want to look at some of these laws and think about, okay, how, do these laws in the book of Leviticus, how does this book of Leviticus help us think about that call to reflect God's glory to the world? Well, some are easy. So if we had read one more verse this morning, we stopped at verse 10 of chapter 19. The next one is, do not steal. Well, that one's pretty, I mean, like, okay, we get that. That's an easy one to translate over and say, that has to do, I understand how that reflects God's goodness to the world. Because if we live in a world where people are stealing, what, it breaks down trust. It affects community, affects all kinds of things. But what about verse 19, the one I referenced just a minute ago, where it talks about not wearing clothing of two different kinds of material. And how does that affect ever the world at the time? So how do these commands help God's people act as a holy people? Especially, for example, the ritual commands. I mean, these ritual, I mean, some of the moral commands about the way we treat other people, those make sense, but how do the ritual commands have to do with, or what do they have to do with holy or living as a holy people? So for example, one I mentioned earlier, the pig has evenly split hooves but does not chew the cud, so it is unclean. You're thinking, but how's that going to help me follow God? Or this one, but you must never eat animals from the sea or from rivers that do not have both fins and scales. They are detestable to you. He says this applies to both little creatures that live in shallow waters and to all creatures that live in the deep. Or this one, if anyone, either a man or woman, has a sore on the head of or chin, the priest must examine it. If he finds it more than skin deep and has fine yellow hair in it, the priest must pronounce the person ceremonially unclean. It is a scabby sore of the head or chin. So, how does it help you be a holy people set apart to declare God's praises? To, like, you got a sore on your chin and you got to go see the priest and say, what do you think? Imagine if every time you got a cut, you had to come and see the pastor and say, you know, I got this cut here. Can you take a look at it? And I was like, oh, no. I don't want to look and see if it's yellow and has a little hair in it. No way. What in the world do those have to do with God bringing this people out of slavery and saying, you are to be my special possession. You are to declare to the world my goodness and greatness. See that little sore on my chin? What? How do those fit together? No idea, right? The strange thing is, if we read through the rest of our scripture, we see things like in Psalm 119, where the psalmist declares again and again, like, your law is a delight to me. That somehow the people of God found these laws to be a joy and a delight. Why? Because, one, God had spoken to them. Many of the people in the ancient world, they were longing to hear from God. And so part of it is, God has given us guidelines how to live. But I think there's something else going on. So I think what's going on is, if you spend so much time thinking about ritual impurity, it will lead you to think even more about moral purity. Imagine if every day you go through life and you're thinking about, can I eat this food? Can I wear these clothes? What else have I done to make me ritually impure? And all of your day is revolved around that, and there are all these rules, all these ideas about what makes you ritually impure. Jay Sklar, this professor who's written this book on Leviticus, often does this with his classes. And he'll have his students spend a week, and he says, I want you to spend this next week and do your best to live by the laws in Leviticus. And then keep a journal. And he says, and then at the end of the week, they turn in their journals and he reads through them. And he says, without fail, what he sees is as the people are writing, the people become more and more aware of God because they're constantly thinking about these states. Now, being ritually impure, it's a lot like catching a cold. Remember we said ritual impurity isn't sinful. There's nothing wrong with it. It's perfectly natural. Women develop ritual impurity for having a baby. Men and women developed ritual impurity if they had sex together. There were all these different things that created ritual impurity. And so it was just an ordinary part of everyday life. You didn't walk down the street and see somebody who was taking the ritual bath and say, oh man, what did they do? Because you were probably going to be there the next day. But what it did was it brought this constant awareness all the time. You were thinking about, what was I doing that might create ritual impurity? And the reason you were concerned about ritual impurity is because you didn't want to defile the tabernacle. You didn't want to defile the presence of God. And so what Leviticus does is it wants people, it invites people to see that every part of their life matters to God. That we can't divide life up and say, well, I got this part of my life and this part of my life. No, all of their life matters to God. So in the same way that like distinguishing between ritual clean and moral clean, then the same becomes with the moral. So that if we're constantly thinking about ritual purity and impurity, then we move into our lives and we begin to think more and more about moral impurity. So for example, let's go back to the dietary laws. You know, we may not understand why particular animals are or are not. And again, how we apply those to modern day life, that's a whole nother conversation. But let's just put ourselves in the place of ancient Israelites receiving these commands. There's no suggestion that they knew why particular animals were clean or not clean. They just knew, I can eat that animal, but I can't eat that animal. But what did that teach them in a sense? It taught them that God set a limit on their physical desires. It may very well have been that there were times where an ancient Israelite looked and, you know, maybe smelled their Canaanite neighbor like barbecuing some pork. And they thought, I really want some of that. But they knew because of Leviticus that God had set a limit on their physical desires. He set a limit on what they could eat, who they could have sex with, all these different things. And how does that translate over? Because if in today's world, and probably back then too, if you read Leviticus 18 and this long list of all the people they weren't supposed to have sex with, you think, what kind of society was this? But the point was that their society, and I think our society, often has this idea that if we have a desire, we should fulfill it. You know, if you want something, if you want to enjoy it, then go ahead and fulfill your desire. What's Leviticus saying? God put limits on your desires. God is saying to us, just because you want something, just because something seems good to you, doesn't mean you should have it. Now, that can often feel like, well, God's so stodgy and stuck up, and why would he put boundaries? Why can't I just do whatever I want? And I think Carmen Imes gave a great image of it. Imagine building a playground for kids, and it's next to a busy road. What's one of the things you would probably put on the playground? A fence, right? Now, somebody might look and say, what are you doing to these kids? You're chaining, you know, you're not letting them run free and be kids. Well, no, you're not letting them run free and be kids because if they do, they could get in the road and get run over. So what have we done? We've set a boundary and say, here's a dividing line. It's a limitation on us. And in the same way, God puts limits on our desires and our wants because he knows what's best. The 5-year-old on the playground may not understand why the fence is there. They may see it as an imposition on their life. In the same way, sometimes we read what the Bible calls to do, and we see it as an imposition on our life, but we trust that God knows better and is saying, I'm putting this boundary up because there's going to be a temptation to cross that boundary, to fulfill your desires because there's something you want inside, because someone's telling you you should do it. And I'm going to put the boundary up because I know that if you cross that boundary, it's going to bring harm to your life. We can think, you know, God says, don't steal. Well, what's the harm if I steal? We might think, well, that company, if I go to Walmart, they make bazillions of dollars and stuff. If I take a few things from them, what harm is done to them? But it's a harm to you. It's a harm to your neighbor. It's harms going on. And so there's categories that are put up. On the other hand, there are some commands that are more clear. So those are the ritual, like the food laws and stuff. But again, here we'll go to Jay Sklar, where he says this. He says, laws reflect the values of the lawgiver. Think about that. When there are laws written, what are they? How do they? They're telling us something about the one who wrote the laws. And since the Lord is holy and good, his laws show Israel how to live out those characteristics in the world. How to embody the Lord's love, justice, mercy, kindness, and goodness. So part of what he's saying is, he's saying, when we look at these laws, we learn something about God. So we're going to go through a few of these ones at the end of in Leviticus. So first one we read was, when you harvest the crops of your land, do not harvest the grain along the edges of your fields, and do not pick up what the harvesters drop. It is the same with your grape crop. Do not strip every last bunch of grapes from the vines, and do not pick up the grapes that fall to the ground. So the idea was, if you had a field, you left parts of the field unharvested. It says, leave them for the poor and the foreigners living among you. I am the Lord your God. He's reminding us, I am the Lord your God. I'm the one who brought you out of slavery. I'm the one who's done this, and I'm calling you to do these things. But why is it important? So you have a field and you leave part of it. And the idea was, you left a part of the field so that those who didn't have fields, didn't have, could come and they could pick, or they could glean from that so they had food to eat. So one of the things you're doing by this is what? Caring for the poor. And there are lots of laws like this in the Bible too. But one thing to think about is, people are going to know if you're doing this one, right? I mean, somebody looks at your field, they're like, hey, that guy's not good. He harvested the whole field. But there's something else going on. If you leave a part of your field unharvested and are giving it away to somebody, what does that mean? That part of the field can't be used to feed your own family, right? So in some sense, there's a bit of trust and sacrifice. You're going with a little less so that the poor and the foreigners, the aliens, the widows are all taken care of. But something else interesting going on, you're not simply giving it, you're not harvesting and then passing it out down the, but you're giving it because those people have to come, then what? They have to come and they pick, and so there's a sense of giving dignity to them. But we see there's this sense of holy living being set apart means putting people before profits. It means trusting and sacrificing. And so we see this law, and maybe it's an example of like, we don't have, most of us don't have fields we're harvesting. One thing, man, we might think about our time. We tend to block out every single hour of our week, right? Every little bit, it's all busy. What if we were to use the hours of our day, the hours of our week, like a field and say, I'm going to leave a part of it unharvested. What does that mean? What I mean by unharvested? Like, I'm not going to put something in that time slot. I'm going to leave it free because somebody might call me and need me. Somebody might suggest something, and then I have that time available to give to them. That's just one idea of the way we might do that. Next one of the commands, do not fraud or rob your neighbor. Do not make your hired workers wait until the next day to receive their pay. Do not insult the deaf or cause the blind to stumble. You must fear the Lord your God, I am the Lord. When I think, God, what kind of horrible people were these? And so they, you know, cause the blind to stumble was like, put a stumbling block. It's like, oh, here's the blind guy. Did they really have to be told that? But the point is what? It's about abuse by the powerful of those who can't defend themselves. Some people have power and they use it. They hold back the wages. They curse the deaf and they trip the blind. In other words, people are at the mercy of others. The deaf and the blind were at the mercy. And so you could do these things to them. And God's saying, don't do that. That's not how a holy people live. We don't take advantage of people because of their situation. We don't take advantage of people because of their difficulties. We don't take advantage of those who can't defend themselves. Next one is, do not twist justice in legal matters by favoring the poor or being partial to the rich and powerful. Always judge people fairly. Do not spread slanderous gossip among your people. Do not stand idly by when your neighbor's life is threatened. I am the Lord. Again, constant reminder, I am God. I brought you out of you. So part of what's going on here, the law in the ancient world was dealt with by neighbors and relationships. And part of what God is getting at here is don't let your personal animosity or refuse distort the proceedings. Because it's tempting, like, you know, if you're brought as a witness, say someone accuses your neighbor, Josiah down here, of stealing something. And then you've been having this disagreement with Josiah. You know, there's been some bad blood between you. Maybe, you know, maybe he crossed, you know, he walked through your field one day, whatever it was. And Josiah has been accused by another neighbor of doing something wrong. And so you're brought as a witness and you say, man, I don't like Josiah. So yeah, Josiah is a terrible guy. You can't believe he ran. He stole one of my cows. What's going on? We're allowing our personal feelings to interfere with justice. And so he's saying, we can't do that. We can't let our personal animosity, our feuds, distort the reality of justice. We can't take those things and bring them in. Next one, do not nurse hatred in your heart for any of your relatives. Confront people directly so you'll not be held guilty for sin. Do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against a fellow Israelite, but love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. Love your neighbor as yourself. Might sound familiar. Because Jesus, when asked what is the greatest commandment, says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. And the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. And here it's in this context of forgiving others, about showing people and treating them the way you want to be treated. So all these rules of Leviticus, some are easier than others to be sure. Some are harder. So what do we do with it all? Maybe we do a series someday. Maybe not. So, but as you're reading through it, if you ever read through it, think like, okay, what is this teaching me about who God is? Or maybe how is this helping the people of Israel think about all the different parts of life and helping them to focus on their eyes on God? So going back to this, that we have a call like the Israelites, 1 Peter 2:9. But you are not like that, for you are a chosen people, you are a holy priest, a holy nation, God's very own possession. As a result, you can show others the goodness of God, for he called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. And so he's getting the point that like, we're the same way. That holiness doesn't mean isolation or rejection of others. It means set apart for a purpose, to show God's love, his mercy, and his justice, not in some parts of life, but in all of life, that we're to be distinct. So Christopher Wright, an Old Testament scholar, says this. He says, if Christians were as serious about moral distinctiveness as Israel was about ritual cleanness, then our salt and light might have greater power in the world. What he's saying is they were so serious when they're thinking about the clothes they wear, the foods they eat, every part of life, and they're thinking about, am I ritually pure or impure? And you think, wow, they were just obsessive. Why did they do that? He's saying, now imagine if we were that serious about being morally pure. If we spent our days, our moments thinking about, am I doing what God has called me to? Am I thinking about being salt and light? Imagine the power it would have in the world. So if we spent our days thinking, how do I speak to other people? Whether it's in real life or online. And I say in real life, online, because online is real life, isn't it? But sometimes we divide those two things up. But it's just as real. There's a real person most of the time at the other end of that. So do we avoid language? I mean, we think of like the cursing the deaf. Do we avoid language that dehumanizes other people? And it's so common in thinking to our election. How much in the political mess of today, I'll call it, that dehumanizing language is used to speak about people, to put them down. Because we are reminded in the Bible that every single person is created in the image of God. Every single person in the world is a bearer of the image of God. And so as people of God, to use language that makes them less than human, that degrades them, that puts them down in any way, is not to be tolerated among Christians. We also ask ourselves, how do we care for the most vulnerable? Because the reality of the world is we often think about what's good for me. What are we thinking about? Who are the most vulnerable in the world? And in each and every situation, each and every scenario, that looks different. Is it the homeless? Is it the ones with addiction? Is it single moms? Is it whatever it is? There are lots of people who are vulnerable to society. Vulnerable in the sense that what? The powerful can take advantage of them. And if you read the Old Testament, the prophets, time and time again, God says, take care of those people. Pay attention to the vulnerable. Pay attention to the people that nobody pays attention to. And he says that because he says, I am the Lord your God. And he's reminding them that when they were enslaved in Egypt, when they were powerless, he paid attention to them. That they were foreigners and strangers and he brought them out. And he says, so now when the foreigners and strangers live among you, take care of them. When the people who don't have power, when the poor are there, you leave some for your fields because they don't have anything. Some of it's donating food to food pantries, and we do many of those ministries, but we also think about in our personal lives, what are the ways that I'm paying attention and making sure that the vulnerable in the world are protected? And those are all different categories, and for each one of us, it's going to look different. When we see someone being mistreated because of their position, the color of their skin, their whatever it is, do we step in and do we make a difference? Or do we say, that's not my problem? We're called to love one another. That's a big word, isn't it? To love one another, to truly love, even across the differences that we have. We show ourselves as salt and light by where we put our trust. And a demonstration of open. I'm going to come back to the election. That no matter what happens at the end of this election, God is still in control. God is still on the throne. There may be hard times ahead, depending, again, whichever side there's going to be. The way this election is playing out, there's going to be half the country votes for one person and half the country votes for another person. Almost down the middle. Which means at the end of this election, there are going to be half the country, half of your neighbors who are disappointed. Maybe they're in fear, maybe they're anxious and you're excited, or the other way around. You're worried and you're anxious and you're upset. Doesn't give us an excuse to hate our opponent. We're called to love. Love your neighbor as yourself. And that, what is that? To consider, how would I want to be treated in this moment? That's what it is. Love your neighbor as yourself. He's saying, how would I want to be treated in this moment? And so to consider those things. So the book of Leviticus is about all of life. That's really what it is. It's a call to say, how in all of my life can I reflect the goodness of God? How in all of my life can I live out the calling to be a holy people? Because God has said here, and I'm saying to you, you are a holy people. Does it mean we're perfect? No. Does it mean we're pure? No. What it means is we have all been set apart. By our relationship with Jesus, we have been set apart to be different. Now, we can only be different by the power of the Spirit. And so we invite God's Spirit to help us change. And we're not doing it to earn favor with God. Being a little more morally pure doesn't earn us brownie points from God. It doesn't earn a little extra gold star. But instead, it's living out this calling to do it. And so in a few minutes, we're going to celebrate at the communion table. And as Bobby Joe said earlier, it's like one of the things we remind ourselves of at the communion table is we all fall short. You know, we sin. We don't do those things. We don't love our neighbor as ourselves. We don't love the Lord with our whole heart, soul, and strength and mind. We fail to love justice and or to do justice, to love mercy, and walk humbly with our God. We fall into all of those things, and so we become morally impure. But the book of Hebrews, another very confusing book of the Bible, granted, which draws a lot on the book of Leviticus, which is probably why it's so confusing. But it talks about the blood of Jesus as a sacrifice. And what it talks about is his blood cleansing us from that sin. And so when we come to the communion table, we come and we remind ourselves, we're impure people. But God has provided a way to be cleaned. God has provided a way for us to be forgiven. And so we're going to come as a people and be reminded of God and his work through Jesus to make us pure so that we can live our lives as a holy people. So may we be his people. May we declare the praises of him who called us out of darkness and into his wonderful light. Amen.